Good evening. I'm Amna Nawaz. Jeff Bennett is away on the News Hour tonight. Israel launches another round of heavy airstrikes in central and southern Gaza, including in refugee camps. We hear from the Israeli ambassador to the United States. A major caravan of migrants travels through Mexico as record numbers continue to arrive at the southern border. And meat grown in laboratories moves closer to store shelves after clearing several regulatory hurdles, potentially changing the future of the U.S. diet.
If we're going to solve the climate problem, we definitely need to move from intensive animal farming that is eating up a third of our planet today to an entirely different approach.
Welcome to the News Hour. Israel's ground offensive in the Gaza Strip continues to expand, as does the human cost. Health officials there say the 11-week-long war has already claimed the lives of more than 21,000 Palestinians, most of them women and children.
As Israeli tanks bombard the Gaza Strip, the peace plan proposed by Egypt and Qatar seems far from reach. Last night, a Hamas official said they've received ceasefire proposals from multiple countries.
The battle and the movement are always open to all initiatives that achieve a comprehensive cessation of aggression against our people and to everything that achieves the highest interests of our people. Our people do not wait for temporary truces.
Israel, meanwhile, shows no sign of slowing down its offensive. The New York Times verified this video from a photographer embedded with Israeli soldiers. It shows a large group of detained Palestinians stripped to their underwear. Some appear to be children or elderly. Other recent videos and photos of strip-search detainees have sparked outrage. Military officials say they must search for weapons, but human rights groups say this violates international detention standards. Today, the Turkish president went as far as comparing Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to Adolf Hitler.
Is what Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu doing any less than Hitler? No. As of now, Hitler was not as rich as this one. This one is richer compared to Hitler. He is receiving support from the West. All sorts of support comes from America. And with all this support, what did they do to more than 20,000 Gazans? They killed them.
As the death toll rises, Gazans still desperately need basics to survive. Aid trucks roll in, but many Palestinians are starving or without water. An Israeli official claimed that United Nations agencies are enabling Hamas.
Unfortunately, to date, the UN aid mechanism in Gaza has been woefully unsuccessful because it goes through UNRWA. Aid simply isn't reaching the people who need it because Hamas hijacks it and UNRWA covers up for it.
Israel announced yesterday it will now consider United Nations employee visas on a case-by-case basis instead of automatic admission.
Today, our lesson.
In corners of Gaza, life, or some version of it, goes on. Tariq al-Nuami lost his teaching job and home to the war, but volunteered to hold English lessons in this shelter.
Since the beginning of the war, we see our children distressed. Their faces pale, sad about the damage and destruction and pain they see. We thought of cheering them up. We suggested the idea of classes in the tents. They liked the idea and developed a passion for it.
Islam Aziz is 10 years old and says she misses her school.
We have the right to an education just like all the children around the world. It has been 81 days since we have been to proper schools.
In this room, a glimmer of a normal childhood, while outside, a war rages on.
Please stop war! Please stop war!
The Israel-Hamas war is approaching the three-month mark. To help explain what Israeli strategy and tactics are and what the future of Gaza may look like, I'm joined now by the Israeli ambassador to the United States, Michael Herzog. He's a retired brigadier general in the Israel Defense Force. Mr. Ambassador, welcome to the News Hour. Thank you for joining us.
Good evening, Amna. Thank you.
So as we mentioned, the war is now heading toward that three-month mark. We know the stated goal of Israel here is to eradicate Hamas and ensure the horrors of October 7th never happen again. Can you update us on where you are on meeting that goal? How much of Hamas have you eliminated?
So First, our goal is twofold. It is to defeat Hamas, to remove the threat of Hamas in Gaza, which means to dismantle their military infrastructure, their military capabilities, and to dismantle their government capabilities that built these military capabilities and operated them on October 7th. Our second goal is to release all of our hostages. We still have close to 130 hostages, including, by the way, Americans. And we will do everything possible in order to release our hostages and bring them back home. We are advancing our military operation in Gaza. We are operating in both the northern part of Gaza and the southern part of Gaza. Our military operation, in military terms, is effective in the sense that we are dismantling the Hamas military infrastructure. Hamas is deployed in 5 brigades and 24 battalions in Gaza. It's an army of terror. And it is a war which is not only overground, but in subterranean, because they built the biggest terror complex in the world, stretching hundreds of kilometers, where they host their leadership, command and control centers, and rockets. So this is a big challenge, but we are moving ahead, and I believe our military operation is effective.
You say it's effective, but what does your intelligence show you in terms of how far along you are in progress of dismantling Hamas? How much of their senior leadership have you targeted?
I'm not going to put numbers on that, but I think in all the areas that we engage their battalions, in the city of Gaza, in Khan Yunis, and elsewhere, we were successful in dismantling these battalions, and I think we dealt a very severe blow to them. There are still several thousand armed people in Gaza, and we haven't touched all of them. And we don't intend to run after each and every one of them, but to break the backbone of Hamas in a way that they will no longer be able to pose a threat to the state of Israel. I think there's still a lot of military work to be done. They continue to this day to fire rockets at the state of Israel. Since the beginning of the war, Hamas and other terror organizations in Gaza fired over 11,000 rockets into Israel and are still hurling our kidnapped civilians. So there's still a long way to go, but I think we're at the point where they understand that they will be defeated militarily.
I'd like to ask you about the video we just reported on. It was shared yesterday. The New York Times verified it this morning. It seems to be a detention area set up by Israel inside a stadium in Gaza. Men stripped to their underwear, detained en masse. Mr. Ambassador, I'm sure you've seen there seem to be children in that group. And human rights groups say that this violates international standards of detention. Is this practice sanctioned by your administration?
So first of all, I'm not sure these pictures are from recent times. We do when we arrest suspects.
I'm sorry, Mr. Ambassador, when would these be from, if not from recent times? These were reportedly shot by an Israeli photographer embedded with the IDF.
I will say that we strip people of their clothes in order to make sure there are no explosive belts or explosive charges or weapons. And I think that is customary. The fact that these photos came out, I don't think this is our policy, and I don't think this was sanctioned by any people with authority in our government. But I will say, from our experience, you talk about children. We have 15, 16, 17, 18-year-old people who are part of the Hamas military wing, who carry weapons and fight our forces, and they killed our soldiers. So we make sure that none of them has explosive bed. But I want to differentiate between the very act and the fact that these photos came out, which again is not our policy.
If this is not your policy, then why does this keep happening? These seems to be groups, large groups of men detained en masse. There were previous videos also showing men detained en masse, similarly stripped, many blindfolded in the backs of military vehicles. Why is this allowed to happen?
They were not put out by any people with authority. There are people with mobile phones who take photos. You can't control all of it. And again, I'm saying it's not our policy to put out these photos. We are against it.
I understand it's not your policy to put them out, but they are out. They have been verified. Why is this practice continuing to happen?
because when you have a situation like that, it is impossible to control each and every mobile phone on the ground.
No, sir, I apologize. Not why is the video coming out. Why are your military forces detaining men en masse, including some children, in this way?
We are at war, let's not forget. And our soldiers get killed in Gaza. Let's not forget that. We are fighting for our lives in Gaza. And when we have terrorists or suspected terrorists, we detain them and we make sure they have no weapons or explosive charges. This is war.
And what qualifies people being suspected terrorists? I mean, we spoke recently to the poet Musab Abu Toha, who said he, even though he was on a list to evacuate with his American citizen son, he was arrested, detained at the Rafah border crossing, beaten and blindfolded for over 2 days. When he asked why he was being held, he said the IDF soldier told him, "You have to prove to us you are not Hamas." Is that the policy by which your soldiers are operating?
We are fighting against over 30,000 terrorists in Gaza. And our soldiers get killed there every day. So there are a lot of people who are terrorists, and there are people who are suspected of being terrorists, and they are being detained in order to investigate and see if that suspicion is right or not. If it is not, we release them. It is not our policy to target innocent civilians or to go after innocent civilians, but we have to make sure we are talking about the protection of our forces, who, as I said, are fighting a very, very difficult war in Gaza and get killed every day.
As we mentioned, that death toll among Palestinians has now risen over 21,000. Women and children reportedly make up most of the dead. We know your intelligence shows you how many people you expect to hit in each strike. And I understand, according to reporting, some of those constraints have been loosened. You previously used to tolerate dozens of civilians as collateral damage. That number has now risen to hundreds. Is there a limit to that number of how many civilian casualties you tolerate?
I totally disagree with that, and I reject that. We do not target civilians, and we're very careful about collateral damage. You cite Hamas numbers from Gaza. There are no other numbers, only Hamas numbers, and the U.S. cites Hamas numbers. And we don't know exactly how many people got killed. We do know that innocent civilians got killed. It's a tragedy. It's a tragedy for every civilian getting killed. But Hamas never tells you. Putting aside, I'm not sure what the exact numbers are, and an organization that carried out a massacre is capable of also putting false numbers outside, but we recognize that civilians were got killed. But they never tell you what's the breakdown between terrorists and innocent civilians. Our forces claim that in the fighting Gaza, in battle, we killed over 8,000 terrorists. You don't know the exact breakdown. And you don't know how many of them are women and children and how many of them are terrorists. These numbers are out by Hamas, and nobody can verify it. And let me give you an example. When the whole world accused Israel of targeting a hospital in Gaza a few weeks ago, I'm sure you remember that, Hamas immediately put out that 470 people got killed in that attack. When the whole world got to the conclusion that it was an errand, Palestinian Islamic Jihad rocket, the numbers dropped dramatically to dozens. Did anybody ask Hamas, where are the 471 people you claimed were killed? Do you still count them or not? So let's be very careful about the numbers. I am not here to claim that innocent civilians do not get killed. This is war and it's tragic. And Hamas embedded itself in civilian population, subterranean and over the ground, and use them as human shield. And this is tragic. But nobody really knows what the exact numbers and the breakdown between terrorists and civilians. We are fighting against over 30,000 armed people in Gaza.
Mr. Bassett, I'll also just clarify these numbers where I was citing come from the United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. I invite you to join us again.
The United Nations Office cites Hamas numbers. They don't have numbers of their own.
Ambassador Michael Herzog, Israeli ambassador to the United States, we thank you for joining us. Please do come back and join us again sometime soon. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
In the day's other headlines, former President Trump will stay on the primary ballot in Michigan. The state Supreme Court won't hear an appeal from voters seeking to disqualify him because of his role on January 6th. The justices wrote in a statement, quote, "We are not persuaded that the questions presented should be reviewed by this court." That comes days after Colorado's Supreme Court deemed Mr. Trump ineligible to run for president in their state. Wintry weather has blanketed parts of Colorado and South Dakota in more than a foot of snow. Nebraska and Wyoming weren't too far behind, with about 11 inches. Meanwhile, strong winds continue to gust across the southern and central plains. The massive storm is expected to bring snow and rain to the northeast later this week. Officials in Kyiv say Russia fired nearly 50 drones at Ukraine overnight and shelled a train station as people were trying to evacuate. The Ukrainian Air Force claims it shot down most of the drones, which were Iranian-made. Still, the attacks killed at least six people, destroyed buildings, and knocked out power to most of the southern city of Kherson. Protests erupted in Congo today, demanding a redo of last week's presidential election. Demonstrators took to the streets of Kinshasa, denouncing what they say was a flawed vote. Police fired tear gas and threw rocks to break up the crowds. One of the main opposition candidates also accused police of firing live bullets. Protesters refused to give up.
The people are resisting. Marching is our constitutional right, and it is not over because they need to take responsibility for this chaotic election. We won't back down.
International observers and rights groups have also questioned the election's integrity. They cited polls that never opened or opened late and many illegible voter cards. Final election results are expected in the coming days. Back in this country, the New York Times filed a federal lawsuit today against Microsoft and OpenAI for using millions of its stories to train chatbots. The Times says it never granted anyone permission to use its content for artificial intelligence purposes. It isn't seeking a specific amount in damages, but said the copyright infringements could be worth, quote, billions of dollars. And on Wall Street today, stocks managed modest gains. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 111 points to close at 37,656. The Nasdaq rose 24 points and the S&P 500 added 7. And two passings to note tonight. Comedian Tom Smothers has died at his home in California after battling cancer. He and his brother Dick hosted the trailblazing Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour in the late 1960s. It mixed humor, music, and controversial topics, often at odds with network censors. Smothers won an honorary Emmy for his work on the show nearly 40 years after it was canceled. Tom Smothers was 86 years old. And South Korean actor Lee Sun-kyun, known for his role in the film Parasite, was found dead today in Seoul in an apparent suicide. He'd been under investigation for alleged drug use. Lee played the father of a wealthy family in Parasite, which won the Oscar for Best Picture in 2020. He also appeared in several popular South Korean TV dramas. Lee Sun-kyun was 48 years old. Still to come on the News Hour, the U.S. Special Envoy for Hostage Affairs discusses efforts to free Americans detained abroad. Thousands of congregations leave the United Methodist Church amid disagreements over theology. Interest in immersive exhibitions skyrockets as the way people consume art evolves, plus much more.
This is the PBS News Hour from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
While the United States was able to negotiate the release of detained Americans in Venezuela, there are still at least four Americans in Russia and approximately seven held in Gaza by Hamas and potentially other militant groups. The U.S. government's point person working to get them all home is Roger Karstens, the Special Presidential Envoy for Hostage Affairs. Ambassador Karstens, welcome back.
Oh, no, thanks for having me tonight.
So I want to begin in Gaza, and I know what is a multi-agency effort to bring home those Americans held in Gaza. I understand Qatar was instrumental in previous successful efforts to release many of the hostages. Things have been at a standstill for a while, though. Now, where is the holdup? Obviously Hamas, right? But are the U.S. and Israel on the same page on this?
As you might imagine, I can't get into the details of negotiation. At times you can, usually after the fact, but right now it just, in a way, doesn't benefit the hostages to get into the nitty-gritty of it. What I can say is that Qatar is playing a very strong and important role as an intermediary. There are times when, of course, the United States does not really have entree into some of the negotiating groups. And this is a case where Qatar has really been able to bring its gravitas in the region to bear. I think where we are, it's a tough fight. I think a lot of the things you read in the newspaper are probably accurately portraying where we are. But the bottom line is, as the president said and as the secretary said, we're in this to make sure that everyone gets back. And even if we were to get all of our Americans back, we are going to stay there and work to get all the hostages back. And we're done when everyone's accounted for.
Have you been able to confirm, at least among the Americans that are held, that they are still alive?
So information still remains sketchy. As you well know, the president announced just a few days ago that we believe one of the American hostages in detention had already passed. For the other seven remaining, of course, the information, I would say we have more information on some, less on others. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, to us, we just have to keep pursuing returning everyone, to include those who do pass away. So the one gentleman that is assessed as being deceased, we still have a responsibility to bring his remains back so that the families can have closure.
The nature of your work is, to say the least, high stakes, but also just things come together at the last minute. I want to ask you about the recent deal. You were able to bring home 10 Americans who were detained in Venezuela in exchange for an ally of Venezuelan President Maduro. How fragile, give us a sense, how fragile are these deals before they're done? I mean, when was this one final before they came home on Wednesday?
To just answer directly, they're always very fragile. There comes a time when, even though we try to give families a sense of what's happening during the discussions, there comes a time we tell the families, like, we just can't talk about it anymore because it seems to get to that point where everything hangs on a thread. Mm-hmm. And that if there's one leak, if there's one false tweak, the other side may actually decide to collapse the negotiation. On this one, we had some details to work out. A lot of good work was done by the United States. Particularly by the White House and the people at the State Department and Western Hemisphere Affairs. But I think we got to the point where we just had to fine-tune a few things. And as a result, on the 20th, we spent about 4 or 5 hours on a very hot airplane tarmac. You can picture six airplanes with their engines continually running. No one's shut down for 6 hours. And just going back and forth between these very loud planes with that heat coming off the tarmac, trying to ensure that everything was wrapped up so that we could begin the switch between the Americans that they were holding and the person that we were holding. But at the end of the day, we were able to pull it all off, and I think a lot of people put the work into. And if I may, it's not just the people who negotiated or at the White House or the State Department, but there are congressmen, senators, nonprofits, individuals like Mickey Bergman of the Richardson Foundation, Jonathan Franks, Eric Lebson, congressmen, senators, their staffs, allies of the United States that all put themselves into this. But at the end of the day, the people that, to my mind, bear the most weight on their back, the families. They're the ones that push us, hold us accountable, sometimes come up with the winning strategy. And they're all doing that to keep their loved ones, bring their loved ones back. And I would even say the people that are in these prisons, they remain strong and they pretty much never lose faith in their country. They know that we're going to come and get them one day.
Speaking of folks in prison, I want to ask you about the Americans who are still in Russia. Tomorrow does mark 5 years since Paul Whelan's wrongful detention in Russia. You put out a statement just this evening saying not a day goes by without intensive U.S. government efforts to bring him home. But he recently did tell reporters he feels betrayed, that he feels that he's been left behind. There have been previous deals that did not include him. Will he be the priority in any potential next Russian swap?
You know, a lot depends on the Russians. I mean, certainly we want to bring both Paul and Evan back. Love to get them both at the same time.
Evan Gershkovich, the Wall Street Journal reporter.
Mm-hmm. But we're working hard. It's kind of a tough thing to tell people that you're working hard because the belief might be that you're not. But at the end of the day, we probably talk to his family members daily. Mm-hmm. We talk to the Wall Street Journal because they maintain an interest in Evan Gershkovich. We talk to them on a weekly basis. But Paul Whelan is just front and center at all times. I probably talk to him once every 2 or 3 weeks. Fletcher Schoen, my case officer, talks to Paul pretty much weekly. But this is something that we work on every day. And that's not just throwing those words out there. Every day we're working on trying to bring Paul home.
We have seen a rise in foreign governments detaining innocent Americans abroad. And the criticism you always get is the more you negotiate with people, you get them to see they can have a financial backer or a close political ally or billions in funds unfrozen by releasing Americans they're holding, that it may incentivize more hostage taking. How is that not the case? Doesn't that seem to be proving true right now?
No, if I were to actually lay all the facts out, I might say that my case numbers are actually going down right now. I think we're in a new field, probably 10 years from now, and we've had a chance to run all the numbers. We can maybe come up with a more conclusive, conclusion. But right now, my numbers are not necessarily going up. They're, if they're steady state or going down, I would say that would be accurate. If Gaza, of course, with 10 hostages being, or 12 hostages, down to 8 that are still unaccounted for, I mean, that kind of skews the numbers a little bit. But, you know, at the end of the day, people don't get back unless you're willing to make these deals. And President Biden and Secretary Blinken have shown great courage in making the hard decisions that bring Americans home. Because unless you make that deal, that person is going to remain in a prison. There's no other way to bring some of these people back other than to make a hard decision.
That is Ambassador Roger Carstens, U.S. Special Presidential Envoy for Hostage Affairs. Ambassador, good to see you. Thank you.
Thank you, as always.
The Biden administration is closing out 2023 in much the same way it began, with headlines about a migrant crisis on the U.S. southern border. Border Patrol agents encountering a record number of people entering the country, a caravan heading toward the border, and American cities struggling to keep up with asylum seekers. As Stephanie Tsai reports, it's with that backdrop that President Biden dispatched three top advisors to Mexico in search of solutions.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrived in Mexico City today, greeted by U.S. Ambassador Ken Salazar. Blinken, along with Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas and other top U.S. officials, met with Mexico's president on their second visit since October to address the migrant crisis. The U.S. is asking López Obrador to make it harder for migrants to move through Mexico and to do more to stop migrants when they try to enter Mexico from Guatemala. In exchange, Mexico wants the U.S. to commit more aid to the migrants' countries of origin and ease sanctions on Venezuela and Cuba. The talks come as record numbers of people try to enter the U.S. from the southern border. At times last week, Customs and Border Protection stopped more than 10,000 people a day, adding to the more than 240,000 migrants that officials encountered in November. The numbers have stretched Border Patrol to its limits, with agents struggling to process the influx as thousands gathered in Eagle Pass, Texas in recent weeks. U.S. Customs and Border Protection closed other ports of entry in Arizona and California in the last month in order to redeploy officers to help with migrant processing. Underlining the pressure on U.S. officials, a caravan of migrants is steadily making its way to the border. An estimated 6,000 people from Central America, Venezuela, Cuba, and elsewhere have been waiting for months in southern Mexico. On Christmas Eve, they began their march northwards under the beating sun. They make up the largest caravan in more than a year. Many young and exhausted families are among the masses, including Jose's.
My daughter can't walk anymore. I carry her in my arms because she needs to rest. She's only 3 years old, and she's not healthy. She's ill.
Rosa journeyed from El Salvador.
I demand politicians to touch their hearts, because many of us are tired, without eating, and with blisters on our feet.
While U.S. leaders seek solutions that would control those coming into the U.S., the migrants seek rest and compassion.
For a closer look at the situation on the southern border, I'm joined by Elliot Spaggett, immigration reporter with the Associated Press. Elliot, thanks so much for joining the NewsHour. What is the goal of the meeting between top Biden administration officials today and the Mexican president?
Well, the U.S. officials haven't said made any public asks, but we can infer from what's been happening over the last few weeks, the numbers are astronomical. They're unprecedented, to use a word of CBP Acting Commissioner Troy Miller, above 10,000 arrests for illegal crossings on many days in December. So they want to get a handle on the numbers. And of course, this is not happening in a political vacuum. There's negotiations in Congress with aid to Ukraine hanging in the balance. So I think, you know, the U.S. officials want to get a little better handle on the numbers. And, you know, to give one specific example, the rail crossings in Eagle Pass, Texas, and in El Paso were closed for 5 days this month and caused a lot of economic losses. They reopened, but what was happening there was people were coming up on the trains through Mexico, and the U.S. wants Mexico to do more to stop that. So more enforcement is what I think the U.S. is looking for.
You visited the Arizona side of the border with Mexico recently. What did you see for yourself about the situation and specifically about the efficacy of the border wall?
Yeah, I was in Lukeville, Arizona, which is one of the hot spots right now. About 3,000 people are crossing a day in that general area, much of it through Lukeville, which is a border crossing that is closed right now because of all the need to focus resources on processing migrants. It's the border crossing, a duty-free shop, and a restaurant. And there's really very few agents around, but lots of people. I saw lots, probably more from Senegal than any other country. Lots from Guinea, Mexico, of course, Guatemala. And they're sawing through the walls, the smugglers are on the Mexican side. They're using construction-grade tools. These are columns that were built during the final days of the Trump administration. They cut through and swing the columns back and forth so people can just walk through, young people, toddlers, older people. It's very easy to get through. And they walk for hours looking for Border Patrol agents who are nowhere to be found. This could probably be stopped by Border Patrol agents, but they just don't have enough there. They're busy processing. Commissioner Miller said he wants Mexico to step up more. There are these breaches, and there were hundreds of them, that they had been welded shut, but the dates were marked on when they had been fixed, and hundreds of them over a 30-mile stretch. And Commissioner Miller said, you know, we need Mexico to step up, to do more to stop people from breaching the wall on the Mexican side.
You've been reporting on the underlying causes of increased migration from climate change to poverty, but you've also emphasized in your recent reporting the role of technology in smuggling operations. I wonder if you would talk a little bit more about what you found out about how that contributes to the increasing flow of migrants.
Yeah, well, it vastly increases global mobility. So we did a story on Mauritanians who are very, very few were crossing. And then around February, March of this year, they were crossing by, you know, several thousand a month, most of them going to Cincinnati or New York. They fly, about 4,000 Chinese are crossing a month through mostly through San Diego. I mentioned the Senegalese, people from Uzbekistan, Turkey, India, thousands from these countries every month. And they, there needs to be a lot more reporting, I think, on this. But there are travel agencies that many of them really are travel agencies, and they help, you know, they arrange flights and communicate virtually over social media. Every migrant has a smartphone. And so they use TikTok and Facebook and YouTube and other apps to get instructions. And so the smugglers are oftentimes not even with them physically. They aren't when they cross the U.S. border. They're just given instructions, cross here, walk until you see a Border Patrol agent. So that is a sea change from just a few years ago.
How would you describe how immigration politics have shifted in the last year?
To the right, for sure. One big development, of course, has been the large influx of migrants from Venezuela and other countries to New York, Chicago, Denver, other Democrat-run cities. And so what we're seeing now with the negotiations in Congress over this, it includes aid to Israel and Ukraine as well as border security measures, is a lot of Democrats saying, yeah, like, John Fetterman of Pennsylvania, even Dick Durbin, who was the original champion of the Dreamer legislation, saying Chuck Schumer, we need to do something. Of course, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party is very much opposed to those changes. They want to keep the asylum system going, and now the Republicans are split too. So we'll see. But I think overall, there seems to be a growing consensus that something needs to be done, and more on the enforcement side.
Elliot Spaggett with the Associated Press, thanks so much for joining us with your insights.
Thank you.
Nearly 90% of Americans eat meat as a part of their diet. But earlier this year, the Agriculture Department approved production of what's known as cultivated meat, that is chicken grown in a lab. That approval clears the way for companies to begin selling poultry produced from animal cells rather than animals bred in factory farms and killed. William Brangham gives us a taste of what the future could hold.
We put a little allium glaze on it, which is just an onion garlic reduction. Just to give it a little color and some flavor on the outside.
At the Good Meat plant in Alameda, California, Chef Nate Park is putting the finishing touches on a dish that is seemingly pulled right out of science fiction.
A lot of people don't know what this is, so there's a tendency to maybe back away because they don't know what it is. But I think once they understand what it is and that it's just chicken and that it's delicious, it'll be very easy for everyone to get on board.
Getting people comfortable with the idea of cultivated chicken is at the heart of operations here at Good Meat. It's one of two companies now federally approved to make it.
We want to slice it in front of you. We want you to see what it is that you're going to get on the plate.
Grilled, sliced, and served with heirloom beans and a sweet potato puree.
If you had said nothing about this, I would just think this was a lovely meal.
Oh, thank you.
It tastes, as the saying goes, like chicken.
It's chicken.
And delicious.
Thank you.
But long before I enjoyed it for lunch today, that chicken meat could only be seen here, inside this bioprocessing lab, as tiny microscopic stem cells. They're all taken from real chickens, without harming them. The cells are then constantly stirred, kept warm, and nourished so that they'll multiply inside these massive bioreactors. It's all part of a lengthy process designed to mirror how actual animals grow.
Cultivated meat has been talked about for over 100 years.
Josh Tetrick is the co-founder and CEO of Eat Just, which operates Good Meat.
What is the rationale for cultivated meat?
First and foremost, we just got to accept people love meat. And it's difficult, really difficult, to get people to stop eating meat and choose beans or some other plant-based source, which would be better for them. So how do you get at that? And I think the answer is you make real meat in exactly the same taste and texture that people are used to, but you make it in a way that doesn't require billions of animals. You just can't feed the world without the billions of animals, because each animal has to be slaughtered.
Global food production is responsible for roughly a third of all the man-made greenhouse gases that are dangerously heating the planet. And meat production is the major driver of that impact, with the majority of the world's croplands and forests being used to grow food for the animals we then eat.
If we're going to solve the climate problem, we definitely need to move from fossil fuels to renewable energy. And we also definitely need to move from intensive animal farming that is eating up a third of our planet today to an entirely different approach.
But not everyone is sold on this new approach.
We can't just take it as a given that cultured meat is good for the environment.
Ned Spang is an associate professor at the University of California, Davis, who studies the links between food and the environment. He says while no animals are being slaughtered, a recent report he co-authored about cultured meat indicates it's not nearly as green as many would hope.
Along the lines of climate emissions or energy use, we found that cultivated meat might actually have more of an impact than the conventional agriculture.
And how is that possible?
Well, the major driver is that these are still animal cells, so they still need to eat food. And basically, just as a cow needs to eat some grass or corn to grow and grow muscle mass, we need to feed the cells. And so we need to feed them glucose for energy and amino acids to build proteins. And it takes a lot of resources to actually make the food to grow these cells to create the cultivated meat.
But Tetrick argues that as the technology improves, cultivated meat has the potential to pollute much less and consume far less land and water than conventional meat. And he argues our current approach, from its cruelty to animals to its environmental impacts, has to change.
We're eating food every day that no one would be proud of if they actually engaged with it.
Several companies have come to market with plant-based meat substitutes, like Beyond Meat or Impossible Burgers, but cultivated meat will likely be a tougher sell. A recent poll from the Associated Press found that half of adults in the U.S. say they would be unlikely to try it, with many citing that it sounded weird.
We found the most effective way to move someone from this is kind of weird to all right, I'm down with it, is to put it on a plate, get them hanging out with their friends, and have them eat the chicken. And then a bit about midway through it, they're like, all right, this is just chicken.
We marinated overnight in an anticucho sauce.
So far, only a few restaurants in the U.S. have actually served cultivated chicken, including China Chilcano in Washington, D.C.
Take it right like this.
Yes, don't be afraid to get a little messy, don't worry.
That is delicious.
It's owned by world-famous chef Jose Andres. And here, head chef Daniel Lugo prepares it as a traditional Peruvian street food.
So when Jose first came to you and said, we'd like to try cooking with this unique type of chicken, what was your reaction?
Well, at first I was super excited and curious. And to be honest, once I tried it, I was super surprised and actually liked it.
But getting cultivated meat both into more restaurants and eventually into grocery stores won't be easy. Good Meat is reportedly looking for ways to cut surging production costs. The company had aimed to eventually produce up to 30 million pounds of meat annually.
Yeah, we are nowhere near the scalability to actually make a dent in this problem. And that was exactly the same way for solar energy 30 years ago. And we were in exactly the same position for electric cars 20 years ago. And if you're ultimately going to shift the system, best to start now, because it's going to be a many, many decade long, very, very hard, uncertain problem to solve.
It's a problem now being tested and tasted in labs like this one. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham in Alameda, California.
One of the dominant Christian denominations in the U.S., the United Methodist Church, is experiencing a major split. Since 2019, more than 7,000 congregations across the country have received approval to leave the Methodist Church. That's about a quarter of all Methodist churches in the U.S., and nearly three-quarters of those departures happened this year. United Methodist leaders gave congregations until December 31st to decide to leave. Factions within the denomination split over disagreements in theology, namely how the church considers LGBTQ plus ministers and congregants. In Oklahoma, where the United Methodist Church was one of the most practiced beliefs in the state, more than 120 congregations voted to leave the church. Adam Kemp is one of our community's correspondents. He is based in Oklahoma City and joins us now. So, Adam, just give us the background we need to understand on this split. How did we get here?
Yeah, we're basically seeing the conclusion of what's been decades worth of debate and discussion in the United Methodist Church over sexuality. It's been a long time coming, and what experts are saying is the largest denominational split since the Civil War, basically. And it's focused on LGBTQ inclusion, whether or not the UMC wants to have LGBTQ pastors or congregants or same-sex marriages within in their congregation. There's been a continuing push despite the fact that the church has kind of been committed to their stance that homosexuality is not in congruence with their teachings. That push, though, for more inclusion has made some of the more conservative groups within the denomination uncomfortable, ultimately with them asking to be let out of the church. So in 2019, a general conference was held in St. Louis where they decided to let individual congregations vote to leave the United Methodist Church, to disaffiliate. Flash forward to, now more than a quarter of all those churches have voted to disaffiliate and leave the church.
Adam, more than 7,000 congregations since 2019 getting approval to leave. What's been the result of those churches leaving?
Right. Well, beyond the huge loss of the number of churches and congregants, it's also given rise to the Global Methodist Church in the United States, which is a more conservative branch of the United Methodist Church. They say they're going to adhere to more Wesleyan roots in their teachings and theology, which would mean, no LGBTQ ministers, no same-sex marriages within those churches. But also interestingly, many churches left the UMC to go non-denominational, to kind of choose their own path, which experts have said that, you know, for five decades straight now has been a choice millions are making, and what they are seeing is becoming one of the larger, church denominations, non-denominations within the U.S.
You've been talking to some people who grew up in the church. How are they grappling with this change?
Yeah, I spoke with local pastor here, Aaron Tiger, who grew up basically in the United Methodist Church, followed in his father's footsteps to become a UMC pastor. Just what that process was like. He now himself is no longer a United Methodist pastor and led a church through the disaffiliation process as well.
It's been hard. I mean, there's just been a lot of grief. While there was a day, October 31st, when I was no longer a United Methodist pastor, I had been in my heart making that decision over the slow process of 4 years. So it was 35 years in the making of a connection, has kind of been 4 years slowly drifting away from seeing myself as a United Methodist, what we call elder in the church.
So Adam, we mentioned that December 31st deadline for congregations to decide if they want to leave or not. What happens next?
Yeah, it's a time for analysis for United Methodist Church in a lot of ways. They might have a better understanding of what comes next at their next general conference, which is this spring, where they will, experts say again, will have a push for more LGBTQ inclusion, including possibly changing their rules to allow for gay ordination as well as same-sex marriages within the church. But experts say the effects of this could be long tail and that the church might have some soul searching to do as they have to analyze whether they can keep the number of employees they have as well as seminaries across the U.S. and ultimately whether they can keep the number of churches they currently do have.
That is Adam Kemp, our communities correspondent based in Oklahoma City. Adam, thank you for your reporting. Good to see you.
Thanks.
In recent years, immersive art exhibitions have become a hot ticket. They put viewers in the midst of the art, often through computer-generated lights and sounds. Special correspondent Kat Wise recently visited an immersive art space in Portland. It's part of our arts and culture series, Canvas.
In one room, colorful graffiti painted virtually on walls. In another, 7,000 LED lights precisely choreographed to an otherworldly soundtrack. These are some of the high-tech experiences, along with technology-free installations, that are part of Hopscotch, an immersive gallery space in Portland that opened in June.
We are an experience that is driven by art.
Nicole Jensen is the co-founder of Hopscotch, which has another location in San Antonio, Texas, that opened in 2020.
We just felt like, as consumers, it's hard to find permanent immersive art experiences or just large-scale art experiences that weren't at a festival. While you might see an interactive art piece at a traditional gallery or at an airport or in a city park, you might not see it next to 14 other similar types of art.
In Portland, those 14 commissioned installations, which come from a mix of local, national, and international artists, are displayed in a former hardware store that Jensen and her team transformed into a sleek, modern space where play is encouraged.
So tell me about this room.
Yeah, we're heading into Quantum Trampoline. This artist is from Russia. We support them. They believe in making art, not war. And they've created
Jensen and I created some art together.
It tracks your movements.
This interactive installation is from a team of artists called Kuflux.
So we're basically becoming part of the art. Is
yeah,
that
they
right?
say you're a particle of light in the infinite cosmos. Obviously, the ability to work with people internationally and remotely is behind a lot of these types of things. It just opens up a whole new world.
While fun is a focus, there are more serious aspects to some of the art as well. In Rainbow Cave, New York artist Barbara Serenka uses 86,000 upcycled plastic bags to highlight the number used around the world about every 5 seconds. Gaze is a collaboration with the Human Rights Campaign.
We take their message and bring it to life through 34 different panels that are uplifting and empowering.
A national nonprofit which advocates for LGBTQ plus rights. Jensen is on the organization's board of governors.
It just was really important for me as a queer person to, when you're a business owner, you know, you can create the spaces you want to be in and you want others to feel comfortable in.
In other rooms, visitors are transported to different realms.
This is Unknown Atmospheres. It was created in collaboration with Parallel Studio. We are looking to match light and sound behavior.
Seth Neal is a Portland sound designer and electric musician who worked on two of the installations. He spent 6 months composing this 5-minute soundtrack.
Sound can really act in an unconscious level and affect people's mood or their perception of other senses in a way that they're not necessarily thinking about it.
While numerous studies have found connections between the arts and human well-being, more research is now underway looking at the specific impacts of immersive art experiences. One study last year by researchers at the University of Pennsylvania found higher levels of immersion were associated with heightened emotions such as happiness, awe, and feeling relaxed. That mini vacation for the heart and mind may be one of the factors leading to the surge of interest in immersive art. Co-founder Jensen says hopscotch tickets, which are limited to about 1,000 a day and cost $24 for adults and $15 for children over the age of 3, have sold out most days since they opened.
Are you trying to attract people who may not have gone to a traditional art gallery before or been interested in traditional art?
Absolutely. My favorite guests are the ones that are drug here by someone, and they have been told through society that they aren't creative or they are not interested in art, or maybe they didn't feel comfortable, frankly, is what I think it comes down to in artistic spaces, and then they have an amazing time. So it's about making people connect.
On a recent afternoon, those connections were being made by visitors of all ages and backgrounds.
I feel like this is a bucket list for Portland.
Suri Johnson and Ashley Stiles, who learned about hopscotch on TikTok, drove down from Seattle.
After each room, we were like, okay. It sparks conversation and emotions. We talked a lot about like how art has the power to make you change your perspective and how you view something that may have happened. And this definitely leaves you feeling something different after every room.
While immersive art has its share of critics, including those who feel the entertainment aspect is emphasized to the detriment of the art, Portland artist Francisco Morales doesn't see it that way.
I think the line between art and entertainment is oftentimes blurred. So I don't necessarily see that as like a positive or a negative thing.
Morales, whose mural depicts predatory advertisements that target Latin American communities, says he's not bothered that some may miss his message.
As an artist, I would rather folks engage with my art at whatever capacity, whether it be with the critical lens or on more of like a superficial kind of like, oh, it's like aesthetically pleasing. So I think that there's validity in like both of those things and like everything in between that spectrum.
Hopscotch's Portland lease goes until 2033. And Jensen says they plan to change out installations roughly every 2 years. They're hoping to open 2 new locations, including a waterfront property in South Los Angeles, over the next several years. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Kat Wise in Portland, Oregon.
And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us.